In this part of Focus 580, we welcome back to the program Jim Kaler. He's professor of astronomy at University of Illinois. Once in a while, on a fairly regular basis, we have astronomers on. Jim and John Dickel, his colleague, are here occasionally. We talk about what you can see in the sky at various times of the year. John, in fact, was just on last week, I think, and we did that. So the program today has a little bit of a different focus. We thought that we might concentrate on what is Jim's particular area of scientific interest and expertise, and that is stars. He has authored a new book, which has just come out, a very nice book in a very handy, compact format. It's titled The Little Book of Stars. It's published by Copernicus Books, and it is small in size, but has a good basic introduction, I think, to what stars are all about.
It's small, but it has a big heart.
Exactly, right. So. And perfect for stocking stuffer in this holiday season. If you have some, perhaps, on your gift list, and we were talking about sort of the level of the book, say maybe high school level who's interested in science or interested in astronomy, this would be a good thing for them. And also, let me mention that Jim will be doing a book signing at the Illini Union Bookstore next month, January 29th. It's a Monday, from 4:30 to 5:30 in the afternoon in their author's corner. So if you'd like to get an autographed copy, you can do that. And questions, of course, are welcome. You want to call us, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Has this always been a... When you think about your involvement with astronomy, has your attraction to stars always been there?
Yeah, really what I fell in love with as a kid and always been interested in it. And then you often tell people, well, what do you do? I do stars, and they look at you blankly like, don't all astronomers do stars? That's what it's all about. But no, I mean, there's lots more. Stars are the most obvious things in the sky. Most of my research was done in interstellar gas clouds, actually, rather than stars. But, of course, they're related to stars, so you get right back to the heart of things eventually anyway. But there are people who get involved in galaxies and planetary research. There's a great depth to this subject and a lot of things that don't specifically involve stars. But I sort of came back to roost in the last 10, 20 years and got much more interested in stars specifically again. Love writing about them.
How many are there?
How many are there? Well, depends on your terms. In the naked eye sky, about 8,000 that the human eye can see with the naked eye over the course of the whole celestial sphere. And in the galaxy, our local assembly, about 200 billion of them. In the visible universe, I guess somewhere around a billion trillion, something like that. It's almost an uncountable number, 100 billion trillion. It gets silly after you can't really conceive numbers like that. The one of the analogies that's often used is that there's more stars in the visible universe than there are grains of sand on all the beaches of the world, which is gives you a sense of the number that are there. And that's just the visible universe, the part that we can actually see. We haven't been able to see everything. We may never see everything.
Well, even counting the stars, the visible stars in the sky, it's a significant task, not to mention counting the stars in our galaxy.
Well, we've cataloged several tens of millions that have sort of catalog names, positional coordinate names. Hubble Space Telescope has to use faint stars for guiding, and we have precise positions of huge numbers of them. The task has been going on for literally millennia. You go back to ancient Greek times, they were making maps of the sky and counting and recording them, beginning to name them and organize them. And it accelerated during the 1700s, 1800s for navigational reasons and for astronomical reasons too. And in our own century, we just cataloged huge numbers of them. You can't get them all. Astronomy is largely a statistical science, and you sample. This would be impossible to catalog them all.
Mm-hmm. Or when I talked with John the other day, one of the things I asked him about was a fairly recently some astronomers announced that they had discovered some more moons of Saturn. And you'd think, well, that was close enough so that we probably should have been able to know how many there were there.
Well, you get these little bitty things, and they're awfully difficult to see from here. You get them down 100 kilometers or so across. They're just very faint little things. There was a new one of Jupiter just found. that brings a total of 17 known ones. And undoubtedly, there are more. You get down to just rocks. You know, where do you stop calling it a moon? We just, if you want to think of the satellites of Saturn, the rings are made of little bitty satellites. See, it's got billions of them, and at some point, the count gets a little bit pointless. We're not at that point yet, certainly, because we're still counting the fairly big bodies. The moon's Jupiter. If Jupiter weren't there, the big ones are so bright you could see them with the naked eye. If Jupiter weren't there, it's just the glare of Jupiter that prevents you from looking at them. You can see them with binoculars. They're so bright and easily found.
Mm-hmm. You talked about the fact that when people talk about, or you say that you're an astronomer and that you are interested in stars, people say, well, yeah, of course. Another thing that maybe would surprise people is that there are a lot of different kinds of stars, and when we look up there, basically they seem all to look the same. They're twinkling points.
Yeah, but they're all different. It's sort of like people all sort of look alike too, except that they all have individual characteristics, and you get to know your friends. And the same is true with stars. There are really no two of them that are exactly alike. You can even see the differences with the naked eye. You can see subtle colors in them, range from kind of a bright bluish white to a fairly orangey red. There's several. You can pick the red ones out fairly easily with the naked eye, and they're all different. I got run a website out of the astronomy department. I do a little essay on a different star every week. I'm up to 150 of them now, and a lot just the naked eye ones, named ones at this point. And I think in the front of it is dedicated to showing that no two stars are alike or something like this. They're all different, and they're all fascinating in their own ways. You could make a life study, and people have done this on one particular star. And, of course, the sun is the favorite.
Mm-hmm. Are there major categories when you talk about different kinds of stars?
Yeah. They've been trying to categorize them since the middle of the 1800s, and we use a system now that was developed around 1890, over a century ago, that just basically they're lettered according to their spectral characteristics, but really it's according to their temperatures. And the old classical OBA, FGKM, any beginning astronomy student gets to learn the sequence. but it's the first thing any astronomer wants to know about a star, what class is it? And it's basically temperature class. Sun's a G star, 6,000, 5,000 degrees surface, absolute temperature. And there are a gazillion different subtypes. I mean, you can spend half a lifetime looking at them all when you get into the... Some of them vary, some of them don't. Some of them have weird chemical compositions. Some of them spin fast, some of them spin slow. They're in various stages of aging. Some of them are brand new. Others are in the process of dying, yet others are totally dead. So it's an immense range of them. You get them from only a few percent the mass of the sun up to maybe 100 times the mass of the sun. Mm-hmm. So there's a tremendous range of characteristics. And we just happen to have a really nice one that hosts the Earth very, very well.
The relationship between the color is determined by the temperature?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Almost entirely by the temperature. A little bit chemical composition in some extreme cases, but mostly by the temperature. The red ones are the cool ones. Temperatures go down around 2,000 degrees or so for most standard stars. They can get lower. In fact, they're discovering now sort of substars, stars that are really don't have enough mass to run the thermonuclear fusion that powers stars like the sun. And you're getting down to the temperature of a self-cleaning oven on some of these things. About 800 degrees right now is the recently discovered minimum at the surface. They're not even visible, wouldn't even be visible to the eye in a telescope. You have to use infrared detectors to find them. So it's that's one of the things that's fascinated me about them is this fantastic range of properties. And the ability, again, of the theoreticians who have been very successful in doing this over the last 50 years to string the different kinds together into an evolutionary flow so you can see what's going to happen to them from birth to death. We've got a very good idea of what's going to happen to the sun over the next 6-7 billion years. And it ain't pretty.
And fortunately, we won't be here to watch it.
It'll take a long time, yeah.
That's one thing we don't have to worry about. Our guest this morning is Jim Kaler. He's professor of astronomy at the University of Illinois and has authored a number of books, including recently The Little Book of Stars, published by Copernicus Books, answering all of your basic star questions right here in this book. And, of course, if you have some basic star questions or other astronomy questions, you can call
me. Yeah, we can open it up to anything.
Sure.
What the heck?
333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, perhaps just as a way of talking about what the life cycle of a star is, Why don't we talk about the sun?
Sure.
Where did the sun come from?
You can look into the Milky Way, those of you who are out in the country and can actually see the Milky Way away from the bright lights of Champaign-Urbana, which just blotted out completely. It's pretty much still overhead in early evenings through Cassiopeia and so on, although it'll get a little bit drabber over the winter. It's this circle of light around the sky that is the disk of the galaxy, and you if you're out in a, say, an August evening sometime out in the woods in the country and you look up, you see the Milky Way's got tremendous structure to it. It's not just a simple white band. There's all kinds of holes and lanes and dark stuff. And it's, those are dark, dusty clouds that block the light of the background. And in those clouds, the temperature drops so low that stars condense. So they get formed out of those clouds, sort of chaotically and randomly. And we've been pretty successful in figuring out the processes that actually do it. So the sun was born about 4.5 billion years ago out of a cloud similar to that. It's long lost its birth cloud, of course, or any siblings it might have had. They tend to be born in groups in these some of these huge clouds and in the hundreds of thousands, even in the hundreds of thousands at times. And It condenses to the point where it fires up the fusion of hydrogen to helium in the core. Temperature's got to be up around 10 million degrees or so. And that stabilizes the star, and the sun's been pretty stable now for the last almost 5 billion years as a result of that thermonuclear fusion. That's what generates the energy of the sun. And we got about another 5 billion years left. Calculations, it takes about 10 billion years from beginning to end to use that core hydrogen up, turn it all into helium, and then the fun starts because the core collapses and then the sun swells and it'll probably swallow Mercury. It'll probably get Venus. The Earth might escape, but it's only barely. The sun will become a giant star. And though it turned kind of cool off the surface, turned kind of reddish, and those are the ones you can go out in the nighttime sky and front bold star of the Big Dipper, Arcturus, front bold star of the Little Dipper. They're all kind of reddish hues, and all of these stars are these giants that are in the process of dying. And the sun will lose all its outer layers eventually and turn into what's called a white dwarf, just a little dim star about the size of the Earth, very compact, metric ton per sugar cube, very dense, and it'll die that way. You say, well, how do you know that? Well, you look out and you see the white dwarfs, you see these little critters, you see the giant stars, you see all of this stuff out there, and application of in principle, relatively simple physical theory shows you that you should get them all in succession. And you explain everything you see. So we figure we know what's going to happen to the sun. And probably a 99.9% certainty.
And
I would say 100% certainty.
All stars follow that same?
The ones like the sun do. Depends a lot on their mass. And then you get these really rare ones. Tiny fraction of stars get up above about 10 times the mass of the sun. And those are the ones you got to watch out for because they'll explode. Sun won't. It'll die as one of these little burnt out little things. But the big ones, and there's several visible to the naked eye, will within the billion years or 100 million years, don't seem to have much choice other than to blow up. Fortunately, they're very rare, so you don't see it very often. We haven't seen an exploder in our galaxy since 1604. So, and that's a good thing. There's a purported death zone around an exploding star of about 30 light years, and if you're inside that, it's going to damage the Earth. Even that far away, the violence of the explosion is just mind-blowing.
And that's a pretty good distance, 30 light years.
Yeah. I mean, heavens, the nearest star is 4 light years away, and we can't get there. We aren't even close to getting to a star. It would take thousands of years of the kind of propulsion systems we have even to get to the nearest one. And here you're talking 30. You're talking many times that distance. Near stars four light years away. So
we're talking this morning with Jim Kaler. He's a professor of astronomy at the U of I. We're talking about stars, and if you have questions, you can call us 333-WYLL, toll-free 800-222-WYLL. Perhaps we should talk about fusion and how
that
differs from fission, which is what you get in a nuclear reactor.
Yeah, or just ordinary uranium. The heavy stuff gets unstable. You get the very heavy elements, and they're unstable when they fall apart. Uranium decays to lead, given enough time. Mm-hmm. And you can fission it artificially if you want as well, produce atomic bombs and reactors and things like this. You get energy out of fissioning heavy atoms, or you get energy out of fusing light atoms. You can also get energy by fusing hydrogen into helium, which is what a hydrogen bomb is all about. We haven't figured out how to actually create peaceful power yet of any sort, actually fusing. The sun does it very nicely. It's a natural reactor because its great mass can drive the temperature up in the core to the point where fusion just naturally occurs. And that actually keeps the sun from shrinking down gravitationally and stabilizes the sun. There's enough in there to go on for 10 billion years. There are other... In a heavy star, what you do is to fuse that hydrogen to helium and then the helium into carbon and so on up the chain, and you fuse up to iron, and that's sort of the bottom of it. You really can't get anything past iron that way to create energy, and if you get an iron core in a heavy star, the core collapses and the star blows up. And the theory's pretty well in hand, actually. A lot of details that aren't understood, but the basic idea is very well in hand. And in the explosion, you create all the natural chemical elements. And all the iron in the world has come from exploding stars, past generations of them. And it's not a speculation. You can watch a star blow up. We can see it happen in other galaxies. And doggone it, you do produce a huge amount of iron in the explosion. Figure the number of exploders that we've had in our galaxy over the last 10 billion years. It creates all the iron you need.
Well, we have a caller. Why don't we talk with them?
Okay.
Gibson City, line number 4. Hello.
Hello, Dr. Kaler.
Hi.
This is Dick Shellman in Gibson City, and we have talked a couple of times before. What I want to ask you is, I believe Venus will come to inferior conjunction at about March 15 or so, and I'm wondering, in the weeks between now and the time of inferior conjunction, will we get a pretty good view of Venus as a crescent?
Oh, yeah. I don't know when. I don't have that in front of me right now. I think it's an early, late winter, I think, it'll reach its brightest point. And when it reaches that, after it passes elongation, its greatest separation from the sun, at that point it appears to be a half phase in the sky.
Yes, sir.
And then after that, shortly before the conjunction, it will appear as a really large crescent. You can actually see it in reasonably high-powered binoculars. It doesn't take much optical power. And there have been arguments for years whether the naked human eye can actually see the crescent of Venus when it's at its largest. And generally people think no, but there have been reports off and on of little kids with really good eyesight saying, oh, Daddy, look, it's a little bitty crescent or something like this. So apparently it's just barely possible. But most of us would need power. Pardon?
I have a 7x50. Will I be able to pick up the crescent at my 7x50?
I don't know. I've got a pair of 11-power binoculars, and I can see it just barely with that. I think it's 7. Depends on your eyes. If you hold them very steadily, you should be able to see it. Uh-huh. See that it's not round in any case, and it kind of depends on how good your eyes are.
I see.
I'll try it myself when it gets up. This would be after it's reached its brightest and is starting to approach the sun again and to go through conjunction. That's when it will be at its largest.
Yes.
And it's a very attractive sight. This really skinny crescent is very pretty. Even the smallest telescope.
Yes, it's a very large but very skinny crescent.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Uh-huh. Okay, thank you. I'll keep a sharp eye out between now and inferior conjunction.
Yeah, by all means, everybody ought to be out there in the winter's cold looking out there in the southwest.
And whenever it's clear, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. And catch Venus. It is just so bright and beautiful right now. It's getting brighter with time, and Venus is over in the southwest, and you look over in the east, and there's Jupiter, not all that much fainter. Evening sky is really getting nicely filled with planets. After a very drab spring, or autumn, rather, when we didn't have any to show our students through the telescope and observing sessions, it's nice to have them back.
Our guest again is Jim Kaler. He's professor of astronomy here at U of I. You have questions. We've been talking a lot about stars, which is the subject of his recent book, The Little Book of Stars, and his special interest. But, of course, other questions. Welcome to 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL.
Well, it brings us back to Venus because you should admire it now because in around 6 or 7 billion years it won't be there anymore because the sun will probably vaporize it when it gets to be a giant star and expands to the orbit of Venus. So enjoy it now when you get the chance, right?
Well, now let me ask you another basic question here. Well, let me ask you a few basic questions. Okay, so fusion, the reaction that powers the sun, happens when we take the simplest atom, hydrogen,
yeah,
and we use that to make the next one up.
Helium.
Which is helium.
Right.
Right, okay. So, and that reaction releases energy,
mm-hmm,
and that's what makes the thing go. So how do we then get from, I want to make sure that I understand this, how do we get then from helium to the other things that
Well,
we have.
You can, if you have enough energy available, you can make all the chemical elements by simply ramming things together at very high speeds. That's what it comes down to. The sun will eventually begin to die when it's hydrogen in the core, not the surface, when the core is all turned to helium. And then gravity takes over and compresses it down, heats it up, and then all of a sudden the helium finds it can fuse itself to carbon and then oxygen. And that's what will happen to the sun. It'll stop there because the sun doesn't have enough mass to make the engine run any farther than that. You get a high-mass star, then the carbon and oxygen, eventually when you've developed a core of carbon and oxygen, that'll squeeze, gravity will squeeze that down, and that'll fuse into a mixture of neon, magnesium, oxygen, and other stuff. And then you squeeze that down, and that gives you heavier elements, and gradually you develop an iron core. But you can't fuse iron and get energy out of it. That's iron just refuses to do anything. It won't fission, it won't fuse under pressure like that. So once you get it, gravity takes over again, and since the iron can't fuse and sort of stop the compression, the core collapses in less than a second. Bang. And you produce a violent explosion. The temperatures go up into the hundreds of billions of degrees and in the explosion, and as the rest of the star gets exploded away, you've got yourself a fantastic nuclear furnace, and in that explosion you create all the elements. There are other ways of doing it. And in even stars like the sun will produce nitrogen, helium, carbon, stuff like that, and get ejected back into space. And in the explosion produces most of the really heavy stuff. And there are just thousands of nuclear reactions that produce literally everything. It'd be difficult to write them all down, some of which absorb energy, some of which create energy. And, you know, we're sitting around the table. I got a gold ring on, a wedding ring that's made in, made a truckload of supernovae. It's about the only place you can get gold. All the uranium was made in supernova explosions, exploding stars, and almost all the heavy stuff.
So actually everything.
Just everything is made there, right. And there are other sources. Stars like the sun will produce elements, too, in their nuclear furnaces, and some of the byproducts get lofted up to the surface of the star, get ejected back into space. And with the theory of this, and if you produce sort of a theoretical model of a galaxy in a computer, and you let all the stars run and explode and eject their gases, and calculate what the chemical composition of the universe ought to be, or the sun ought to be, you get the chemical composition of the sun. It works. Works remarkably well.
Okay. Well, let's talk with another person here. They're over in Indiana on our line number 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
This is probably a tangential question, but where can one find the names of the 32 satellites of our planets?
They're listed in a variety of books. The best one I know of off the top of my head is called The New Solar System, and I've seen it in local bookstores. You can certainly order it. You may be able to find it in the library, and I can't remember who the authors are. I should, but I can't remember. But the title is The New Solar System, and that has a wonderful appendix in it that lists everything, and you can get the names there.
May I ask you another question?
Sure.
How does your book compare with The Golden Guide to Stars?
Well, this isn't meant for children, if that's what you're referring to. This is an adult book, and certainly high school students wouldn't have any trouble with it. But it's meant, I think, I would say, if I had to guess, high school and up. It's an introductory book for adults who are interested in the stellar science and stars, know what they're like, what they do, how we've used them over the years to navigate and tell time, a variety of things, how we've even told fortunes with them, their application to human life in a lot of ways. It tries to cover the basics of what they're all about and what they've meant to humanity.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks. Well, John was here the other day. He was talking about how he was coming up to giving a final in his introductory class, and he said he was convinced that some percentage of his students would come away thinking that they had taken a course in astrology.
Yes. That does happen. I once had I address it in class because there are a lot of people who believe in it, and talk about its history and what it is. Sort of is a system of fortune telling and the like, and how it doesn't really have anything to do with astronomy, but most people really really think it does. I mean, it's got a long parallel history with astronomy, and I can be a little sarcastic about it at times in classes. I had a very nasty note pinned to my door once after a class with someone who took real offense because I did not say nice things about astrology. So there, people are taking it with great seriousness out there.
All right. We're a little bit past the midpoint here, and your questions are welcome about astronomy with U of I astronomer Jim Kaler, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We have someone next in Rantoul, and this is line one. Hello.
Hello?
Yes.
Yes, I had a question about what your feelings are regarding life on Mars.
It doesn't look too likely. There's been evidence for it off and on, and then the evidence seems to disappear. And the only the thing that's close to viable evidence are these little micro or nano fossils that they have found in the Mars rock that they picked up out of Antarctica. And that's been heavily challenged by the geologists, saying you get the same structures through natural geological processes. There's no compelling evidence at all that there's life there. And that doesn't mean there isn't. It's just that there's no real evidence for it at this point that I think is anywhere close to convincing. And I think the only way you're going to find out is to be able to go there with either with robotic craft or humans and take core samples, really sample the planet and bring it home, not rely on an accidental rock that was exploded off Mars and that happened to hit the Earth.
Oh. And
I don't think Elvis lives there. That's been suggested off and on.
Mm-hmm. Are your feelings similar to Carl Sagan about the high probability of life somewhere in the Milky Way galaxy?
Well, again, there's no compelling evidence for it. That becomes a philosophical question at this point. My feeling is that, yeah, there is. It's a philosophical point of view. I can't quite believe that this is all just for us. Maybe it is, but I don't know. There is no evidence for it at all other than right here on Earth. Doesn't mean you can't go out and look or shouldn't. I think it's a wonderful thing to go out and look through the various SETI programs. I think they're a good idea. But again, there's no evidence.
Okay.
Sure.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks. Certainly there are scientists who suggest that conditions might be right on some of the satellites of other planets in our solar system.
Europa has been suggested, satellite of Jupiter, because it apparently has a warm ocean beneath all that and an icy surface. And the planets are turning up. There are about 40 discovered planets out there, not visibly seen, but you can tell by the effect that they have on the stars that the planets are there. There's no question about that, hardly any question about it anymore. They're not conducive to life. They're Jupiter-like planets. But where they exist, well, maybe planets like the Earth exist too, and you get enough of those, maybe there's life elsewhere. It seems reasonable to suppose that. But again, there's no evidence for it.
All right. Let's go next to line number two. Someone here locally in Champaign-Urbana. Hello. Line
Hi.
Two. Yes.
I was wondering if there's some place in the immediate vicinity that's good for stargazing. There's so much light pollution around. I just wondered where people go or if
There are various locations. If I want to get out, I just hit a country road someplace where there isn't any traffic and stop the car and get out. that may or may not be a good idea. I don't know. The Champaign-Urbana Astronomy Club has the local U of I Astronomy Club together have what's called a dark site down south of the airport. You can find out information on that by calling Starkel Planetarium.
Okay.
And or the Astronomy Club. I think they'll give you information on that. They host open houses down there on occasion. But it's some of the state parks around here as well. They occasionally have star parties. There's not too much that's organized. I say I just find myself a nice, quiet dirt road someplace, and usually the traffic is down to the point where there's maybe one car an hour, and that's fine.
Okay, thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
All right, thank you. And again, locally here, line three. Hello.
Hello.
Mm-hmm.
In several years at the University of Illinois, I've heard much about the fundamental contributions that Professor Eben has made to the understanding of stars, but I've never had it explained to me in terms that that someone in the humanities could understand. Could you explain in layman's terms what his research has contributed?
Yeah, sure I can, because I've worked fairly closely with him over the years, and a lot of chapter 6 of this little book is describes a lot of the work he's done. He has been instrumental in developing theories of stellar structure and the theories of how stars evolve. I mean, a lot of people have worked in this field over the years, but he's got a sterling record of theory in how the process actually works and how stars live their lives as hydrogen fusers in terms of the real hardcore theory, the numbers, and how they develop and how they evolve. And he, among others, have demonstrated exactly how the sun will turn into a giant star, how as a giant star it will begin to fuse helium in its core into carbon, and how some of that carbon gets lofted up to the surface of the star and gets ejected from the star, and a good fraction of the carbon, including a good fraction of what you're made of, has come from stars like the sun by processes that have been described by Iggo Eben and his collaborators. He was also instrumental then in seeing what happens next, which is the contraction of that carbon core, which drives the star even to greater size as a red giant star, and at that point the star will approach the orbit of the Earth, and how these stars lose mass and how they turn into white dwarfs. The whole process has been pretty well elucidated by Iggo and his friends and collaborators. They've just done a brilliant job of connecting the various kinds of stars we see into a flow of theory. He's also done a great deal of work with doubling, and that's something that's often ignored in textbook descriptions of stellar evolution and stellar processes and stellar death. If you get two stars that are close together and they're evolving at different paces at different times, they can do really weird things to each other. They'll throw matter back and forth, one to the other. We actually see that happen, and Iggo has worked pretty hard trying to figure out what happens if you get two stars that are really close together and how one affects the other's evolution. And that has a powerful effect upon exploding stars, has a powerful effect on evolution upon the galaxy. Does that help?
Yes. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
All right. Thank you for the call. Again, we have a caller here locally. Line 1, they're next. Hello.
Good morning. I have a question I don't quite know how to phrase in the proper, language, but I've just tuned in, so I hope this isn't a repeat in part of what may have gone on earlier. The expansion of the universe keeps going between, it's going to be expanding forever. Other people come up with something new that says it's probably going to be closed onto itself. What are the factors that go into that, historically, and then what are the current factors that have influenced the reevaluation of the expansion or the contraction, where it's ultimately going to go?
Well, it's funny you should bring that up. I had a couple of conversations recently about this, where I'll give it away to all my future Astronomy 100 students that usually the last question on my exam is what is the nature of the universe? Is it closed, open, going to contract, going to expand forever, going to accelerate? And the question pretty much stays the same, but the answers have continued to change over the last 20 years. It doesn't seem to be the same two semesters in a row. The factors that go into it are really ability to observe and to observe accurately, and the sizes of the telescopes that you use. The Hubble Space Telescope has probably been the biggest single factor in helping to elucidate how the universe, our present view at least, of what the universe is going to do. That and our ability to sense the other wavelengths of the spectrum, to be able to sense and record and measure the so-called cosmic background radiation, which is the remnant radiation of the Big Bang, cooled now at only 3 degrees above absolute zero.
How is the cosmic background radiation a factor in the determination of whether it's going to stay?
Well, you can observe fluctuations in it, and these fluctuations are sensitive to all the parameters of the universe, it turns out, if you get yourself a really good theoretician who can evaluate how the expansion rate and so on can factor into this. They're going to be launching several satellites to observe the background radiation and to observe its fluctuations. That's really at the heart of it, because that shows you what the universe was like in the very, very early days, not too terribly long after the Big Bang. The other has been our ability to measure distances over very large paths, over very large distances. When I broke into this business, you had trouble measuring distances any more than, you know, 20, 30 light years away, and you really had to just guess and guess and guess at some of the distances of galaxies, and that's been improving dramatically. We can now resolve stars and other galaxies whose absolute brightness, as we know, that's been one of the key projects of the Hubble Space Telescope, allowing us to look out into the tens of millions of years. And now we're beginning to find other exploding stars that would allow us to get distances out to billions of light years away. And that's really been the biggest single key factor. Given what we know about these distances implies that the universe is not only expanding, it may actually be accelerating. And there seems to be some mysterious source of energy that's being pumped into it that nobody really understands very well.
So it tweaks depending on observation?
More than any single thing, yeah. Okay. It's been the ability to get the Hubble Space Telescope above the Earth's atmosphere, where you can see to very, very fine detail to very great distances, in addition to building much larger instruments on the ground. I mean, you know, for years, Palomar at 5 meters across rained, and now we've got 2 10-meters atop Mauna Kea in Hawaii, several 8-meter telescopes, and there are plans for a 30-meter in California. The Scandinavians recently announced a suggestion that they're going to, with the European community, build 100 meters. So it's, I don't know where the end of this is going to be. I wouldn't bet the farm that everybody has got it right at this point, not given what I've seen. There may well be, and I would be amazed if there weren't some surprises along the way.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
All right, thanks for the call. We have about 10 minutes left. Our guest is Jim Kaler. He's professor of astronomy here at University of Illinois, author of several books, including the new one, which is The Little Book of Stars, published by Copernicus. If you're interested in learning more about stars, you can look for that, and questions are welcome. 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. We had some questions the other day when John was here, and I think someone actually called in off the air asking the same question. They're interested in when the conditions might be right to see the space station. And apparently it's so bright that at certain times you can see it, but that's sort of the catch. You can't see it all the time. It's only particular times that you can
see it. Yeah, it can be predicted for any given location. I think there are websites that will predict it. I don't know. I don't know the answer
to
that.
And on the UVI, on your astronomy website?
I don't even have a link to that. I suppose I ought to try to find out, because I've had this question before. It's not really an astronomical thing. It's just, you know,
sort of a curiosity.
Yeah, it's a curiosity, and you can see. Satellites are not difficult to see. You can go out almost any twilight and look up. If you're patient, you'll see a satellite look like a high-flying airplane until it disappears into your shadow and goes away, and it doesn't have strobe lights on it. You usually tell the difference that way, which airplanes do. The space station was just a brighter version of that, and I'm not sure it's the brightest one. And back in 1961, I think, we launched the Echo balloon, which was a huge thing. It was supposed to reflect radio signals. It was a primitive attempt at transatlantic communication by bouncing the signals off thing, but it was in near orbit, and man, that thing was bright. It was amazing. It was about almost as bright as Venus. So there's nothing unusual about bright satellites. This the Iridium satellite system that Motorola launched, if they caught glints of sunlight, and they could be predicted as well, just blossomed up brighter than Venus. I've had a number of calls on that. What is that thing I saw? You know, the other, is it a meteor? No, it's just an iridium flare. And I'm a little bit concerned about this, because the situation can probably only get worse and worse with these bright things that are orbiting the Earth. And, astronomers are going to have to start being careful, because one of these things passes across your field of view, it's not going to do your detectors any good. Mm-hmm. And I think it's, you know, you're beginning to deal with some, not just light pollution on the ground, but light pollution in the sky. And as pretty as the space station might be to see, I'm not sure I'm a big fan of being able to see it.
Okay. We have some other calls here. A couple of minutes left. Let's talk with someone else locally on line one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I just wanted to throw out, there's a great website if you want to find the International Space Station.
Thank you.
Actually, they predict iridium flares for you.
It's heavens-above.com.
Oh, yeah. Someone called in the other day, a different person who mentioned the same one. And so you can go there and you put in your location and it tells you.
Go there, you can actually tell them Urbana, and they'll tell you the next time you'll see the space station near any iridium flares, and they'll tell you where to look, the magnitude, and the exact time.
Thank you. What's the name of that again?
Heavens-above.com.
Okay. Thank you very much.
We appreciate that. That's I'm glad that the caller mentioned it, because indeed, when John was on the other day, somebody else called in and gave that site, and I pulled it up on the laptop here, and it looks like it should be pretty easy to use.
Yes, they're not. Once you have the equations of the orbits are not it's not hard to predict.
Yeah. Okay. So
I
that's
just can't do it myself.
www.heavens-above. Just like it sounds, heavens-above.com. And it'll not only will it point those things out, but I think that it also will tell you other things like, you know, where you see the planets and maybe some basic stars and constellations and things like that. Okay, very good. Thanks for that. To another caller here, line two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Could you recommend a reading on black holes that's in layman's language, not too technical?
Oh, there are not off the top of my head. If you can call me at the office, I can probably give you a couple. There are three or four. There's an older one by Kaufman that was pretty good and quite readable, and there are two or three others that are pretty good, and I'd have to dig them out of my library.
Okay, what's your number?
It's 217-333-9382.
Thank you very much.
Sure.
All right, thank you. Anything really new when it comes to black holes?
Well, they're big and they're black and they're holes. there's always something new coming along. They discovered within the last year one apparently naked black hole. You detect them when they're in orbit around more or less normal stars, and through their action on the star. This seems to be the only conclusion, is that you got a black hole orbiting the star. But there's a lot of programs over the last few years that involve what's called gravitational lensing. If you get one star exactly in back of another, the gravity of the star in front can lens the light from the star in back and make it kind of blossom, make it bloom, make it look brighter. This is a byproduct of Einstein's relativity and the bending of space-time. And some astronomers observed one star just sort of blossom up and then fade back again, and had all the characteristics of a black hole passing in front of the star. And it may be the first actual discovery of a free black hole in space, one without a companion.
Hmm. And black holes, they also are something that are produced by stars as they go through their...
You can get into a lot of arguments about that, but the wisdom at this point is that they are probably caused by the upper end of the high-mass stars. It's above 10 that you get the explosions, and maybe above 30, 40... solar masses, that these are the things that produce black holes, either by explosions or the darn things just collapse into themselves and disappear. And there are all manner of theories for this, and it's not understood. It's really not understood how you produce them. We have to sort of leave it at that. We're almost sure they're there, and we're almost sure that the only way we can produce them is through the collapse of high-mass stars, but the process isn't understood.
Let me go back to I'm still, you know, thinking about the fusion and the life cycle of the star. We talked about the fact that what we do is we take hydrogen, we fuse it, and we make helium. And then when all of the hydrogen in the core of the star gets used up, then the helium starts to fuse.
The helium core will collapse, actually contract over a period of millions of years under gravity. It just squeezes down. And just like the mixture in a diesel engine, as it squeezes down, it heats up. And it reaches a point of about 100 million degrees where the helium can then begin to fuse into carbon. Mm-hmm. It requires progressively higher and higher temperatures to get the engine to go to higher and higher mass atoms. And it requires higher temperatures yet to get the helium to fuse, the carbon to fuse into magnesium or something even heavier. And that's not available in the sun. So the sun will stop as a little ball of carbon and oxygen and locked up forever as this little bitty white dwarf.
So I guess the thing I was wondering about was when the core collapses, then, though, the star gets bigger.
Yeah, that's it. The stars behave; they behave just the opposite of what you'd expect them to do. They always seem to do this. It's the core that's contracting, but that generates so much energy that you take the outer parts of the star, and that temporarily blossoms outward and expands. The sun will expand to beyond the orbit of Venus right now, and it's the sun is about 1/100 the size of the Earth's orbit, give or take, the radius of the Earth's orbit, and it'll expand to actually probably pretty close to the size of the orbit of the Earth in a few billion years, and it'll also begin to lose mass like crazy, and it'll lose that outer envelope, will literally get lost, and that reduces the gravitational interaction between the Earth and the Sun, and the Earth will probably spiral away, so we may save ourselves. That's, I guess, the best we can do.
So the temperature, then the fusion of the helium generates much higher temperatures than the fusion of the hydrogen?
No, it's the higher temperatures that generate the fusion of the helium. Works the other way around. See, gravity is the driving force here. If there weren't any such thing as fusion, the sun would be luminous for a while, but it'd keep shrinking right down to a point because gravity would be producing all of the energy simply by compression and making the sun hot enough to radiate. And it's the fusion that stops the contraction. That's why the sun's so stable. As long as you got that fusion going on, gravity can't do anything. As soon as if it's like two forces battling each other, and eventually when the fusion runs out, which runs effectively on what's called the strong force, which is what binds atoms together, the gravity takes over again, and then gravity generates the energy of the star. And then the helium fusion picks up, and then helium does it fusion for, then it's gravity wins. And then gravity eventually pretty much wins the battle till you get down to the white dwarf proportions and all kinds of other forces sort of keep the thing stable, which are explained in the book. In high-mass stars, gravity wins. The really high-mass, when you produce the black hole, gravity wins forever. It's an immensely powerful driver of the stars.
All right. That's what we come away with from the program today. Gravity wins.
Gravity wins.
All right. Thanks, Jim.
You're welcome.
Appreciate it. Jim Kaler, professor of astronomy at University of Illinois here in Urbana-Champaign. You're interested in learning basic stuff about stars, look for his book, The Little Book of Stars. It's published by Copernicus Books.